Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Byron Joel, a permaculture designer, teacher, and practitioner from Margaret River, Australia, where he operates Oak Tree Designs. We originally sat down to speak about his background and work as a professional designer in Australia, but didn't wind up going in that direction at all. Rather, we had a very powerful, personal, and candid conversation. This is, like my interview with Dave Jackie, kind of open and honest, for those of you who have listened to that particular piece. If you haven't, the whole archives are still available through the RSS feed on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, so go look that up and give it a listen. In the space that Byron and I created for one another, we talk about finding a calling to practice permaculture, and with it a transformative experience that delivered us from the paths we were on to something better. We also touch on the history of permaculture and where we stand in the current wave of permaculture growth and transition from the earliest pioneers to the next generation of designers who will change the world. We also talk about hope and the importance of preserving cultural traditions. Every interview recorded for this show, every guest I speak with, is important to me and transforms the way that I look at the world and what we can do to create a better place. Sometimes, however, one stands out that really touches me and makes me a better person for it. This is one of those conversations. If you enjoy this interview or any episode in the archives, please make a donation to the show so that I can keep this generous cycle of sharing going on in the world. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Byron Joel. I'll join you afterwards to close out this episode. Well then, Byron, since you're ready for this conversation, why don't you give us a bit of your biography, background, how you came to the work that you're doing, and we'll take things from there.
Okay, well thank you for having me. Yeah, my name is Byron Joel. I'm from southwestern Australia, a town called Fremantle. I currently live about 3 hours south of that in Margaret River, which is a big wine-growing tourism area on the coast. My background for permaculture-related stuff started when I was a kid. My dad ran his own irrigation and landscaping company, so I was kind of exposed to that side of things early on. And I think it was about when I was about 21, I picked up a book, and a couple of years later, I'd done my first PDC. And then by 2009, I was doing my second PDC and was kind of working my way through the literature, practicing at home, kind of small scale stuff. And then 2010, I took the 10-week internship at Zaytuna Farm under Jeff and Nadia Lawton. And after that, I returned to my home in Western Australia, but I kind of pined for the subtropics and for the experience that I had on the farm because it was so invigorating and refreshing. So I bugged Jeff Lawton until he gave me a job, and then I moved back with my family to live and work there for a year or so as nursery manager and woofer coordinator. And then I moved to New Zealand to work at the Permaculture Research Institute of New Zealand as their nursery manager. Now we are back in southwestern Australia where I run a design and consultancy company called Oak Tree Designs. I'm not sure if that qualifies as the long or the short version, but there you go.
I would say that that's the shorter version relative to how these things normally go. That clocks in at about 2 minutes. I've had some that run, 15 or 20. Before you moved into the world of permaculture, did you go off to the university and study anything in particular similar to that, or did you have a different path that kind of got you there?
In my 20s, I have since gotten a diploma in horticulture. I did design at university, but it wasn't kind of permaculture related. And this is something I've not mentioned in other interviews, but I had a very, very challenging late teens and 20s. And I was acutely, acutely disillusioned and disenfranchised with the world around me to the point where I was almost didn't function. I was really fringe, really borderline. At some stages of my life, almost homeless, barefoot. The only job I could hold down for years at a time was kind of pulling beer at a bar, and even that was pretty challenging. And permaculture was something that slowly kind of healed me, I guess, because it, you know, that relieving moment when it kind of sinks in and you realize that, oh, you know, even if there's a great deal of physical work that has to be done and we still have to figure out a few nuts and bolts, techniques and strategies and whatnot, we're almost halfway in terms of that first step being taken. And it was kind of like this relieving moment. And as you delve further and further into it, for me anyway, it was ever more healing. So I don't know. Does that answer the question?
You answered the question in the way that it needed to be answered in the space in which it was asked.
Great.
The repeated themes that occur for me in this space as these conversations occur, this will come out obviously months before this interview that we're doing today, but a piece that I was editing earlier was a roundtable discussion that I had with four local permaculture practitioners. And it was the first time where we ever recorded anything live like that. And a part of our conversation was about the healing that needs to be done. And what you spoke to also makes me think about the healing that occurs within an open and forgiving environment that I found that the permaculture design courses and the material provide for some people.
You can see why some people are so impacted by PDC. For some people, they go along and it's like, you know, yeah, I learned a lot and that's very practical. And, you know, I'm excited to go and build my vegetable garden and all the rest. But some people, it's extremely cathartic. They just did not realize that there was that kind of community or dialogue occurring. And it's everything that they've been waiting for. I think, you know, we've got a long path back toward kind of communion with the natural world and with the planet. And it's not like we're going to click our fingers and suddenly be standing around in loincloths with spears as hunter-gatherers again. You know, it's like this permaculture offers this beautiful path back toward that communion. And I think that's something on the tip of everyone's tongue and heart at the moment, is that kind of movement back to a communion with the natural world.
I can say from my own experience that I took my PDC in 2010. And, you know, I'm 30 years old at that point. It seemed as if that was the first time in my life where I felt empowered to do something in my own way. The social side of permaculture is what I continue to explore more and more as I continue to walk down my own road with this. But this isn't about my direction and my story, but rather yours. And where would you like to take this conversation?
Well, we can just let it flow, but through, like yesterday, the social side of things for me is still tricky. Like I'm still ironing out a lot of creases in my kind of social fabric. Like I've spent time living and working on, you know, eco-villages or intentional communities, what have you, and I found it really challenging. It kind of brings you face to face with a lot of stuff that you didn't even know was there. And it might not even be a huge deal. It's not like it needs to be some immense skeleton in the closet, but just little habits and irks that you have to deal with, that you didn't have to deal with in the past, that kind of come up. And sometimes they can knock you off balance. Yesterday even, I had a group around at my house teaching kids. My wife has initiated a group for the local homeschoolers. It's like a little nature group for the kids, and they just learn different things each week about certain, you know, natural function and different things. And we were looking at oak trees and the difference between cork oak and English oak and the acorns and the leaves and how they differ. And I found myself then even still around people of like mind and, you know, fairly intelligent folks and very, very lovely. My personal reaction to be around people is kind of a reclusive one. Like I'm just noticing my kind of almost, you know, subconscious pull is for me to like disappear when standing in a group talking. I don't have to be the center of attention either. It's just like my propensity to kind of want to disappear and escape and go walk off into the woods and leave everyone else to it. So yeah, I think the social stuff for me is the most challenging, definitely.
And I look at the other side of that and I feel as if I was gifted with a pair of left black thumbs. So When it comes to the gardening side of things, it's garlic and strawberries is about it.
I'm more than happy to be left alone by myself, tending to things. That's my favorite. If we were living in a village, I'd be the guy, you know, within proximity to it, but, you know, a few hundred meters off alone into the woods with his own little hut, kind of a member of the village, but not a member of the village, with a bone through his nose.
When I was younger, that was a piercing that I wanted to get done, but I always heard that it was like getting punched very hard in the nose.
Yeah, I never got that one. I did have a face full of metal at one stage, but not anymore.
I had a couple that were a bit painful to have put in, but I've since moved away from that, and I'm continuing in the family's tradition of tattoos.
Oh, true. Okay. Yeah, I've got one tattoo. It was done with a bamboo stick. Traditional Japanese technique, which apparently is less painful than the conventional method.
I've heard that, but I haven't found anybody who will do that. As we're having this conversation, there's a very nice lady who I'm going to pay large sums of money to inflict varying amounts of pain on me in the name of art, because we're putting together a full pair of sleeves. But that comes from my own family story. My father was a biker. I don't know if you have those kinds of traditions in Australia or not.
We do, but it's usually associated with underground organized crime.
Those types of motorcycle clubs were not, like, as I was going through, but my father rode, my uncle rode, they both had lots of tattoos and things. It's part of that kind of culture within my own family.
Right. Yeah, no, I didn't have that. I was told, you know, if I came home with a tattoo, I'd be kicked out of home. And then when I came home with a tattoo, Dad just kind of rolled his eyes and, you know, didn't quite kick me out of home, but it certainly wasn't part of our family culture.
What was it that inspired you to walk down this road of permaculture?
I really felt like there wasn't another option for me. Like, as I just discussed earlier, I was in such a place of disorientation. I was so lost. It was either that or continue to do what I was doing, which was writing music and, you know, just wandering. Like, I was really not in a good place for a long time. And I guess the catalyst for it becoming more of, you know, a focused direction was meeting my wife, who did a lot to assist me and kind of help me out of that state, and having kids. So it was, yeah, there's that knowing chuckle again.
Yes, yes.
So, like, I probably, if I hadn't met my wife and had kids, I would probably still be that barefoot, you know, freak, you know, wandering around aimlessly. But I needed to kind of pull it together. There was that impetus to put the pedal to the metal. And, yeah, I did. So what was originally a passion, it was always a passion, then became like a career path. And I'm really glad that that's occurred, because I've surprised myself at what I'm capable of doing. It's been a really pleasant surprise, the whole passage.
That pleasant surprise and the successes that you've had, does it come from a series of small successes that got you to a point of confidence where you could, if you will, face that unknown, that sense of possibility that could be success or failure, of growth or of returning to something else, that gave you the ability to continue to step forward and move through this process?
I think it was half necessity. There was nothing else I could do. It was either that or have some just menial job that simply paid the bills and nothing else. That wasn't an option for me. I'm the kind of person where, you know, I call it a weakness, but if I'm not doing something that I'm inspired by, I become quite, you know, put out, I'll say. I don't enjoy it at all. It really affects me. So there was that, but also, yeah, it's definitely just baby steps, you know, baby steps and building confidence and, you know, the positive feedback. I find it difficult to, like, leap in really deep. I get really terrified of taking too big a step. Reminds me of a story. I was in Morocco assisting Jeff Lawton, co-teach at PDC. And at that stage, I hadn't taught any PDCs. I had done teaching, but it was all, you know, more comfortable subject matters, you know, like forestry and horticulture and stuff that I'm really passionate about. And it was day 3 or 4, and it was this wonderful site in Morocco, and class starts at 9 o'clock, and it's 9:05, and the room's full, the tent is full, and Jeff's not there. which is, you know, quite unusual for him. But I'm like, okay, well, it's 9 o'clock now and Jeff's not here. He must just be, you know, getting ready. I'll start proceedings. Does anyone have any questions? So we start talking, people are asking questions, and 9:30, I'm like, well, you're still not here. I might as well start the curriculum. And I think it was by about 9:45, it dawned on me, he's not coming. He's not showing up. He's abandoned me, the bastard. And he, that was his mentoring technique, to just not show up and throw me in the deep end. I think he had a sense of me being a naturally perhaps too hesitant a person, and he just pushed me out there in front of the crowd with no notes, no preparation whatsoever, and I had to teach the whole day, which mercifully was trees and their energy transactions. If it had been another subject matter, I may not have pulled it off quite as well. That's one way to do it, I suppose. But the feeling afterwards was awesome. It was like, oh, wow, I did it. You know, that was fantastic.
When we were setting up this interview, the whole international dateline and setting times and things, that I had to move our first conversation ahead a day. And part of that was because I had an exam last night that was one that was the first of its kind that I'd ever taken, this instructor with this group. And oh, I was nervous for the entire 2 hours and the back and forth and everything that we went, but that feeling of elation when I got through it and I went, you know, it doesn't matter whether or not I pass or failed, I learned a great deal from this experience.
That tension, that seems to build prior to anything of value, and that amazing release afterwards, it's the best. If only I could remember that every time I'm in that tense space. Don't worry, just, you know, the next stage is going to be a blissful orgasmic elation. Probably wouldn't look so bad.
That discomfort is that moment before growth occurs.
Yeah, it's almost as if part of you knows it's about to die. Like there's this little part of you that knows it's not going to be hanging around anymore because it's going to have to be shed. You know, that part of you that thinks it can't. It's freaking out because it's about to end.
You've been along a lot of the ride with the podcast as a listener.
Right.
And, you know, we've shared in some of our email exchanges and other things some of what that experience is like to be growing and moving and not knowing where the next piece is. But what you said about that part of yourself that you know is dying in that moment as, you know, this growth occurs, it's something that I spent, after I was done high school and went off to college, I spent about a decade of my life really, really angry with everything. And it was this manifestation of, when I look back on it now, of course, with hindsight, was that I wasn't in a place of right livelihood. I wasn't doing the things that were meaningful or mattered to me.
Right.
And then as I found that, which happens to be through this path of permaculture and podcasting and talking to incredible folks such as yourself, when all that anger went away and the release that came with it, knowing that that part of myself that had held on to that for so long, like a safety blanket, was gone, and that I'd kind of personally arrived into myself and the person that all these other people had always seen within me, but that I had never been able to recognize until that moment.
Yeah, I can relate totally, man. You know, I didn't quite intend for this chat to be so personal. Like, it's great. I'm loving it. It's fantastic. But I had the same experience, like just a decade or more of serious self-depreciation in all sorts of different ways. And it's really, really nice to let that go. And I feel like in the last kind of year or two or three, there's been a massive turnaround. And I've seen it in lots of my friends as well. I don't know what it is. Perhaps there was something to the whole 2012 idea that was floating around, but something seems to have switched. And it's as if stuff that for years, this heavy emotional kind of dross and baggage that people seem to be carrying around and was so difficult to work their way through, it's like, you know, that was grease in the pan. And we've been trying to clean this greasy pan with just water. And all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, detergent has been thrown into it and it's just kind of sliding off now. Things are becoming much lighter, I think, anyway. I mean, it's worldwide. It's, you could argue otherwise, you know, that there's more darkness and chaos occurring now than ever. I don't know. I see that. I think people have turned a massive corner in the last kind of couple of years. They may not always get it right in terms of where exactly to kind of apply their energies, but look at how much movement there is occurring now in the right directions, in positive directions. I think it's really refreshing. Do you feel like we're collectively moving in the right direction?
I feel like there's an, for lack of a better term, an energy building, that there is a momentum in the work that's being done to really move in a transformative direction. When I look at the amount of growth that's occurring within the numbers that I have for the podcast, as I talk to folks who are teaching locally, and they're to a point now where they can't teach anymore because they're full.
Right.
The things that they're focusing on are loaded. The projects that they're working on are starting to take off. You know, there's more of a demand for consulting and people asking questions and going, well, I want a garden, but I want to learn more about this permaculture thing. But being open to, well, let's step back from the garden. Let's talk about permaculture as design. And then we'll talk about the garden as a place where we can design. And then with, I guess, this current maturity within the perspective and the conversations that are being had, there's a broader, more, for lack of a better term in the moment, universal understanding of what we're capable of being able to accomplish.
Yeah, it's as if the models have really been integrated and digested, or the potential, you know what I mean? Like, you know, when I just showed a friend recently when I was in LA, the before and after shots of the Los Valley Plateau project. And she's a very, very smart woman. She's a doctor of anthropology, and she's a woman who's very connected to nature. She spent a year living by herself as a very beautiful Australian woman alone with Amazonian tribe. So she's got a very good sense of the natural world and of traditional human systems. And she's been living in LA for a number of years now, and it's kind of taken its toll on her. And she's with whom I stayed with her and her husband when I was in LA and going to Permaculture Voices recently. You know, so I've arrived to see them, and then I've driven south to Temecula for a few days. And then when I get back, she said, you know, I've just looked up permaculture while you're away, and, you know, it's amazing. I had no idea what it is. It's so relieving. It's given me this kind of relief and excitement, and I want to do permaculture now. How do I do it? What do I do? I was like, oh, wow, this is incredible. And then I showed her the before and after shots of the Los Valley Plateau project, and she was like, oh, my God, that's amazing. I didn't know this was possible. And it's just that message that's going out now. Despite the kind of hands-on nuts and bolts techniques and strategies of how to do things, just the fact that it is possible. And there are models building, more and more models all the time, visual models. I think it's having its effect on people, because before they believed the hype, that there was no option. I think this is, yeah, we're realizing that there is option. A lot of us have known for a long time that there's option, that there's a better way. Even before they'd heard the word permaculture, there was this kind of knowing. I think that's half of what upset me so much during my adolescence and 20s, was this really strong sensation of what was possible. But, you know, you wake up every day and you're bombarded with what you're bombarded with, and that it's the distance between where we were or where we are and what we know is possible. And that's a really painful thing for some people.
There are only so many times that you can be told no before you think that that is the only answer.
Right. Yeah. And they did a pretty damn good job of convincing us. Very clever.
Mark Lakeman said it about, you know, whose story are you going to inhabit? And I think that's one of the things when I look at, you know, your question about what do I see? And I find more and more people are stepping up and stepping into roles where they can be mentors and helping provide people with an authentic relationship in which they can work through their problems and find the models that work for them. That it's about the, what is it? Is it mentor and mentee? Is that the right pair for that?
We can use that. It makes sense, yeah.
The person who is being mentored, that they're the ones who are really in the place to determine where they're going. And they're just being guided by someone who cares about that person and the work that they're doing in a way that is meaningful and giving towards them.
Absolutely. And I think our generation suffered from a lack of role models. And that's something I'm very drawn to, the idea of just being a good ancestor, like providing that space. You know, you don't necessarily have to have all the answers, but, you know, just to be able to point in a direction and say, yes, you know, I too have covered that ground. I have experienced that as well. You know, I'm one step ahead of you. Here's what I've learned. And just to hold that space of caring and being able to point, I don't know if there's much more you can do. That much alone is so beneficial to people who are feeling, you know, disorientated and lost and overwhelmed.
As so many of the stories that come from those who I speak with, many, many of us over the last, 35 years or so, since permaculture was really birthed onto the scene, we've come a long way. But those of us who are standing here in this position now, we've been able to follow those who went before us, but they were still trying to find their own path. So we were kind of clearing up behind them. We're standing in a place now where we can take this energy and these ideas and be able to use the models that exist in the world around us, combine them with the concepts of permaculture and build something better for those who are going to take this mantle from us in a year or 10 years or a generation and really begin to build those million villages that will make a difference.
It's going to be fascinating to watch the next version or next generation. The metaphor of the pioneer plant has been applied often to those first generation or second generation, depending on how you look at it. Folks like Bill Mollison himself, I mean, say what you want about his character, but if he had been a timid, shy, fragile little teacup, but with the same context and experience and valuable information and message, you know, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation if he hadn't gone out for 10 or 15 years traveling the world, disseminating these ideas, swimming against the current, which in those days was considerable, and being able to do it with, you know, his kind of almost indignant surety. I'm glad I don't have to do that. We've got an army now. There wasn't one then.
I can only think of a couple of people who I've met in the community since I've really become a part of it, even with the hundreds of people who I've interviewed and spoke with, who I think could, you know, rattle the saber, if you will, and go out and, you know, go tell permaculture on the mountain in the way that Bill did. I'm certainly not that person. I think about myself or Jack Spierko or Paul Wheaton or any of the other podcasters. Every episode that one of us releases probably reaches a larger audience in a week than Bill reached in, well, really up until the publication of the designer's manual. Thousands and thousands of people instantaneously, thanks to the internet. And yet we're able to do that because he and those other people went out in groups of 5 and 10 and 20 and taught this. And now, you know, I can speak with you 12 hours ahead of me. It's Wednesday where you are. It's Tuesday as I record this here in Pennsylvania. With like no delay, we can go and get copies of all these books and have them available. And if there are any moments when we need somebody, it's like, oh, well, who do I know in the community who does this? And send an email, place a phone call, and find the people who can lift us up and carry us forward. And, well, yeah, you know, we have this permaculture army.
And then thanks to, you know, the communication technologies and being able to share stories of techniques and successes, we're now finding that what was in lots of ways speculation and conjecture in terms of particular strategies, or this is what will happen if, that you found in kind of first generation permaculture, it wasn't always so well trialed. It was a very, very good idea in lots of cases, but when it came to actually practice it, it may or may not actually work. But now these things have been road tested, and you find templates like Darren Doherty. Are you familiar with Darren Doherty's work?
I'm trying to remember if I'm thinking of the right person or not.
Darren's an Australian practitioner, and he's carrying P.A. Yeoman's keyline mantle in lots of ways forth. But Darren grew up on a keyline design property. So he's got agriculture in his blood. But then he's taken permaculture and holistic management and keyline design methods and all different things, and he's road tested them very successfully over a 20 or 30 year career with thousands of projects in the ground. And he's got a really good sense of production, of what actually needs to happen for, you know, product to be produced. and he's about to release a handbook based on his design template called the Regen 10, which is in turn based on Yeoman's keyline scale of permanence, but with a few tweaks here and there. This is not meant to be a plug for Darren, but it's just things like that. Like, we are now at a point where we have road tested so much and we are so far ahead in terms of what actually works. And I'd love to be a fly on the wall for the next 100, 150 years just to observe how this is going to play out. It's going to be fascinating.
And don't feel in any way bad about plugging Darren, because I was going to plug Dave Jackie and Eric Tonesmeyer, because their work with the Edible Forest Gardens, Volume 1 and Volume 2, is, you know, kind of like my perfect handbook here in the northeastern United States.
Oh, it would be ideal for you, wouldn't it? Yeah.
And I combine that with Ben Law's work as a woodsman, and I look at that and I go, huh, pretty much everything he's doing could be perfectly replicated here where I live.
Yeah, absolutely. I love his work, and I'm really looking forward to Jackie and I forget the other chap's name, but they're doing the Coppice Agroforestry book.
Yes, that is Mark Krawcheck.
Yeah, you guys in your temperate broadleaf woodlands, you don't know how lucky you are. You should come and spend some time in southwestern Australian dry sclerophyll eucalypt forest and see how much fun it is.
You say that, but I think about, you know, this incredible winter. We just had snow on the ground today in, you know, the end of March, and now there's a good chance we'll get some more in April. And I think about what I would trade for you to have your climate in the subtropics for a year.
I'm not subtropical. I'm Mediterranean. I was, when I was living at the PRI, that's subtropical, but now I'm in a thoroughly Mediterranean climate in the southwest. So it's a big difference. There's the east coast of Australia is not everywhere, but it's subtropical, and you know, that the flora is that kind of succulent leafy green stuff. Down here where I am, it's all sclerophyll, dry, waxy, oily, rot resistant. Like, there can be 3 or 4 feet of eucalyptus litter on the ground at any given time because it just doesn't rot down because it's so full of oils.
This is where my brain thinks of something that I read a long time ago, was that in the United States, our earthworms were introduced from Europe, and that the forest litter from the deciduous woodlands in the eastern United States, you know, that leaf litter would pile feet deep. And I'm just wondering, do you have earthworms in that area of Australia to help decompose that at all? Or is it because of the texture and makeup of those eucalypt leaves that cause it to not break down?
You know, I'm stumped. I do not know if the worm species here are native. I think the greater issue was the management by local indigenous communities, Aboriginal communities. For thousands of years, they had fire stick management where they would burn off. And it's well reported and documented in the journals of the early settlers and the scientists, the botanists, the captains, and who first visited Australia. Time and time again, they would state that it looked like a gentleman's park from England, because you had these huge, almost feature trees of eucalypts, really big old grand trees, quite vastly spaced, with a savanna grassland underneath because of the burning off. So this litter didn't build up. According to books like Bill Gamage's The Biggest Estate on Earth, where he goes into this quite thoroughly, it was a continent-wide management process. So, like, just as like with M. Kat Anderson's book, was it Tending the Wild? That was a look into pre-colonial Californian indigenous tribal land management. They realize now it wasn't just hunter-gatherer, it was hunter-gatherer-cultivator. And it's the same in Australia. There's this continent-wide sort of food forestry, but of course the Europeans didn't have eyes to see it, and they let their stock graze it down, and then they went and logged it all. So they've cut down these great big grandfather trees, and then they've stopped the burning, and the bush that's regrown is super thick and messy and tangled and dense and doesn't really resemble what was here beforehand. So you know, European Australians for the last God knows how many generations have grown up with this idea of the Australian bushland, which is actually a relatively very new dynamic. So that kind of litter wasn't a natural thing.
And my understanding is that the first peoples to Australia, and I apologize because I don't know the proper language.
It's Aborigine.
Aborigine?
Yeah, so Aboriginal is a broader word meaning indigenous people to any given area, or not even people. I think it spreads to anything. But Aborigine, with an E on the end, is in reference to indigenous mainland Australians. I think I've got that right.
The indigenous peoples of Australia, those cultures were there for 30, 40, 50,000 years, depending on some of the different pieces that I've encountered. So there was a long history of that style of management continent-wide.
Just to go back a little bit, 30 is very conservative. It's now quite commonly agreed upon that it's at least 60,000 years. There are people who are saying it's 80,000 years, and there's quite good evidence to suggest it's 80,000 years. And then pushing the far edge is people who think it's 120,000. That may or may not be the case, but that's being put forward by a number of different parties at the moment. They've been here a very, very long time.
That provides a really rich background of Native stories, and that is part of the language here in the United States of that indigenous wisdom for the land management within an area.
It does, and it would have had we paid attention to it. But Australia has a very dark history. Most places around the world where you had European colonial activity has a pretty dark history. But Australia has a very, very regrettable history in terms of the relationship between the European colonialists and the indigenous populations. Entire areas were just wiped off the map. And because our cultures were so different, so utterly removed from each other, there was very little room for meeting halfway. Like I'm not an expert on North American indigenous cultures, but I get the feeling that there was a lot more in common between European and Native American culture than there was between European and Native Australian. And even like the Maori, the Polynesian Maori of New Zealand, they were living in villages. They had a similar kind of hierarchy system to the Europeans. And there was that kind of, they were able to meet culturally somewhere in the middle. But Aboriginal Australians are such a unique, it does not get any more earthy, grounded, and, you know, just super, super connected to the earth than the Australian Aborigines. That they were almost seen as being alien, and a lot of wisdom was lost. I mean, for the longest surviving nations on the planet, and most of their cultural practices have been lost. It's very sad, and it's a story that's not really told and recognized internationally, actually, but it's there's not a lot left of what was of their culture. Sorry to bring everyone down.
The part of me that was so many years ago looking to go off and become a sociologist and an anthropologist, well, more than half a lifetime ago, 18 years ago at this point, I just think about collecting those stories now, about connecting with all the cultures that we have around us to hear those stories. I have a 2-hour audio file sitting on my computer that I haven't edited yet that I recorded about a year ago with my grandmother before she passed away. And it's those family stories that are a part of that and the things that I have as an individual to learn from her. It's a lot to take in about these different, well, I'll fall back on what I know and fall back on permaculture is these different zones that we have of influence and what we can do now to interact with these different pieces and make a difference.
It's a tough swallow. The loss of so many human cultural practices and forms now, and it's not nice. There's nothing nice about it when you're actually living in that time period and witnessing it. At the same time, all is in flux. There's no such thing as a permanent form. There's been, you can't even put a number on it, of different cultural forms that have come and gone throughout time. And arguably, perhaps humanity needed to be so reshuffled. Maybe we needed some sort of a clean slate to start from, to kind of rebuild a new way of being with ourselves and in relationship to each other and the planet. And I don't know. I can only hope that there's some kind of greater meaning to it, because if there isn't, it's a terribly sad thing.
In sharing a story with a local community leader, we were talking about what it's like to get to know something intimately by knowing its name. Teaching my children the names of the plants and the animals, that they know it, and by knowing about it, they can care about it, and by caring about it, they can love it and tend it and take care of it. And in the conversation from that very close personal space, the fellow who I was speaking with said, the other side of that, though, is being out in the middle of nowhere and looking up at the stars and seeing the vastness of the universe and knowing how small you really are in the grand scheme of things. And we both turned that around in the conversation, though, about how being that small and that apparently so insignificant can be a very empowering place at the same time, because this is our life and our moment, and we matter.
Yeah, I find it equal parts kind of terrifying and relieving. I think it's terribly relieving to think that I'm not that important. I don't even know where to go with that. You've kind of just blown my brain.
I take a joy in life and the places that we go, and I can't help but laugh because I spend so much time being so angry that I couldn't. I kind of need to make up for that lost time. But we've really had a much more just kind of a personal chat about life and some of the things that we've encountered, about the ups and the downs and the good, the bad, the degrading and the painful, but the positive and the empowering. I don't really know where else to go from here.
Well, we could leave it at that. I thought it was wonderful. I've had a lovely chat.
I've enjoyed myself immensely through this. Thank you. I enjoy these spaces, and I appreciate everything that you've added to my life by being a part of it for this hour.
Oh, thank you very much. Likewise, it's been a pleasure.
And that was Byron Joel. I'm not going to add anything to this conversation except to say that you can find out more about Byron, his work, and listen to other interviews he's given by going to oaktreedesigns.com.au. I've also included a link to that and the other resources mentioned in this episode to the show notes at thepermaculturepodcast.com. If you'd like to reach out to me for whatever reason, the usual ways are by phone, 717-827-6266, email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, via Skype, where I am Permaculture Podcast, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Until the next time, create a better world each day by taking care of the earth, yourself, and each other.